This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to our no-holds-barred forum for discussing what's good, bad, ugly, and just plain silly in the arena of doing business with the government. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Stan Soloway, who is president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. You can find them at psc.org. Is that right?
pscouncil.org.
pscouncil.org. Sorry. Stan, there's a lot of stuff going on the Hill. I'm assuming part of it's because it's an election year, and part of it's because Hill denizens are easily bored and have to mess with things that work. Let's lead off. Alan was on Francis's show a few days back and talking about a letter that you guys sent over to Secretary Panetta. Do you want to explain the issues?
Sure. The letter went over to Secretary Panetta was in response to another letter that two dozen senators had signed, in which they expressed concern to Secretary Panetta that in the face of the caps on federal employee hiring and salary freezes and so forth, that there was nothing being done, in their words, and I'm paraphrasing, not directly quoting, to constrain more expensive contractors. And while we certainly understand, if that's their perception, why that would raise concerns, I felt it was important to get on the record to explain what's actually going on. What we've seen over the last couple of years is a $20 or $25 billion reduction in the government spending on services, which translates immediately into tens of thousands of jobs. The president's budget has a $75 billion reduction over 5 years in the acquisition of weapon systems at DOD and the investment accounts. That clearly has a major jobs impact. So to suggest that contractors are immune from the budget cuts is absurd. And the idea that they're more expensive is a whole other discussion that we could have. But I think the real point that we were trying to make is that there is no segment of the public marketplace, whether it's public employees, contractors, universities, anybody else, who are immune from what's going on with the budget, and that we all recognize that there are some significant fiscal challenges. Everybody's going to have to do their share, and we're all going to feel the effects. When it comes to contractors, one difference is, and this is not a qualitative statement, not meant as a qualitative statement, that when budgets are cut, programs are delayed, programs are reduced or finished, the contractors go away. You don't need an act of Congress or specific regulatory action to reduce contractors. They come and go as the budget and program requirements dictate. We've argued that to put arbitrary contractor cuts in law is kind of absurd because they're going to be affected and are already being affected by the budget. Plus, we've had a number of initiatives. Secretary Gates had his 10% reduction in certain kinds of advisory and assistance services. There's an OMB directive to try to reduce contracting by 15%. Really, by eliminating contracting that's no longer needed, this is their objective there, and so what we really wanted to point out is that you don't need to make policy to drive an impact. This is sort of we have to look at this as sort of a whole of government approach, if you will, and all the different parts of the ecosystem that support the government, from federal employees to contractors to universities, nonprofits, and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that natural attrition then would lead to it because they'd be fewer contracts, so why impose the limit?
That's the point, and it's already actually happening. So, we want also want to make clear that we're no more in favor of arbitrary cuts of the federal workforce. I don't think that's a smart way to manage. There are areas in which the government needs to grow its capabilities, even in a down budget. There are areas in which the government is simply not competitive for talent, and you need to address that issue because it's talent the government clearly needs. So we're no more in favor of arbitrary cuts to the federal workforce than we are in trying to make arbitrary cuts to contracts.
Okay. So you guys shot off a letter to Secretary Panetta. Does this let's just continue down the hot policy issue line. Capping executive salaries or all salaries, actually, at this point for contractors seems like another arbitrary decision on the part of people on the Hill. And I know you have some thoughts on that.
Well, it is arbitrary, and I think there are several different issues. There's a confluence of several different issues here. So let me just sort of rack and stack sort of the, or review the bidding, as you will. For a number of years, there has been a statutory provision that requires OMB using a formula to establish a fair and reasonable level at which companies could allocate the salaries of their top five most highly paid executives across their government contracts, their cost-type contracts in their base. And then the idea of the formula was to assess the commercial marketplace, determine what was fair and reasonable for a CEO of a company that size, and cap the allowable cost for a company at that level. The idea being, we're going to enable you to hire top executive talent, but we're not going to overpay and get into these egregious executive salaries and executive compensation that we've seen in some cases in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worked.
Sort of like the banks they bailed out.
Well, I'm not going to go there. That's it. So it's and the formula's worked relatively well. Last year, in the defense bill, for defense contracts only, they took that provision and said this applies to all contractor employees. But it's still the formula. And so while it changed the nature and purpose of it a little bit, and which is a concern. The fact that it's tied to this, you know, top five most highly paid executive salaries and so forth, it didn't have a big impact because the number was high enough. This year, it's changed again, and there is a proposal in Congress to get rid of the formula altogether and just arbitrarily cap contractor salaries. The one proposal on the Hill is to cap it at the president's salary, which is sort of an odd number to pick because although the president's salary is $400,000, you think of all what would otherwise be taxable benefits that go along with that are food, security, travel, and all that.
Nice plane.
But beyond that, it's just an arbitrary cap. It has nothing to do with what the market would drive. So it may sound like a good number, and it may sound like good rhetoric to say we're not going to pay any executive more than we pay the president of the United States. That's nice, but that's not how president of the United States' salary is set, number one. Number two, that's not reality. More importantly, by arbitrarily capping all contractor employee salaries, It's ignoring the fact that there are areas in the economy that are driving compensation, whatever the human capital market says it's worth. I mean, we have a shortage of technology skills in the United States. And so technology skilled workers are commanding pretty hefty salaries in the commercial marketplace, and we need to be able to compete for them. So there's that issue. You also have some provisions in law that have urged DOD and others to try to hold contractor wages at FY10 levels and to prevent or to renegotiate what might otherwise have been wage escalation clauses in contracts, the normal escalation of the cost of living increases and so forth. So there's a lot of other pressures in the market. The president has actually proposed, and this was, I think, a bit stunning when it first came out last year, has actually proposed that the cap be brought down to a $200,000 level for all contractor employees. And in that case, you're going to effectively be saddling contractors with the exact same competitive problems that the government has in attracting certain kinds of key talent. And the idea there is the rhetoric with that is we shouldn't be paying contractors any more than we pay government executives. And I think what everybody's missing, and an issue that the public employee unions have appropriately been raising for years, is there is a pronounced pay gap between what the government pays and what the commercial marketplace pays for lots of talent. And the Congressional Budget Office just came out with a report last year that documented this pay gap that exists. The higher end skills you go, the bigger the gap becomes. Mm-hmm. And so if there is this pay gap and we're not going to be able to address it, and I don't think it's realistic to think we're going to address it in legislation for federal employees in the current environment, although I think in some areas it would be great to be able to, because the government needs to hire some of these skills. Why would you want to do that same thing to the conduit you have, which is the contractors, to that talent? So you could shut that, you could shut that conduit off and end up not being able to access that talent at all. So it's really a nonsensical approach. It could really disadvantage those who are trying to bring innovative solutions to the government. But in this day and age, as you said, it's election year. The rhetoric is good and so forth. So it's a debate that's beginning.
Okay, is there a possibility this debate will abate after the election, or?
Who knows? I mean, tell me what's going to happen in the elections and what the public mood's going to be. I think that you know, contractors are have been and are in the limelight. And I think that in many ways it's to be expected and it shouldn't upset nor surprise people. I mean, The industry that supports the government is large. It's robust. It's a strong industry that's done well, and much like any other industry segment, particularly in this case, because we're dealing with the public dollars and the public trust, it shouldn't surprise us that we're in the limelight and people are focusing on it. The key there, though, is to maintain a balance and a sense of the sort of the reality of the reason this industry exists is to provide capabilities to the government that it doesn't have organically, whether it's people, technology, equipment, what it might be. And we need to be realistic and balance all of that sort of limelight against the realities of the marketplace so we can make sure that we're getting the best of the marketplace without getting ripped off. And that balance is always tough in a hot political environment.
Understood. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Back after these messages.
Central Michigan University has 7 centers right here in Metro D.C. Surprise? CMU has been educating Metro D.C. professionals since 1975, offering accredited adult-friendly degree programs designed for working professionals.
I have been to every center in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. The professors are exceptional. The advisors are great. I just really enjoy the environment of CMU.
Stop by our open house at CMU's Alexandria Center on Wednesday, May 16th between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. We'll have staff, program directors, and faculty on hand to answer all of your questions about our quality degrees and student services. Plus, you can talk with financial aid advisors, career services counselors, and drop in for continuous presentations on how to take an online class. Apply at the open house and we'll waive the $50 application fee. Certain restrictions apply. Go to cmich.edu/metrodc or call 877-679-1268 to let us know you're coming to CMU's Alexandria Center open house. Certified to operate by Chev.
Here's Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Grimshaw, CIO G6ADCCP Team Army, on the Federal Executive Forum on Virtualization, sponsored by Informatica.
We're going to get security actually baked into our operating environments. Instead of trying to do it all individually, it's going to be part of that standard software stack that will really enable users to focus on the capability and not to worry about all of the infrastructure underneath it.
Listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group. Log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Government IT leaders have one thing in common. All are challenged to do more with less while meeting the aggressive federal data center consolidation initiative mandates. Agencies can realize their data center consolidation goals by looking beyond the traditional bricks and mortar of consolidation to reduce infrastructure and utility costs. Informatica customers know that the true long-term savings come through a comprehensive application retirement, data archiving, and virtualization strategy. Visit Informatica.com today to see how they can help your organization.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Join the United States Geospatial Intelligence Foundation for GeoInt Community Week, June 4th through 8th, featuring classified and unclassified workshops, demonstrations, exhibits, briefings, and networking opportunities. USGIF's GeoInt Community Week is a great opportunity to learn more about the GeoInt issues affecting the defense, intelligence, and homeland security communities. Register and learn more at usgif.org, the United States Geospatial Intelligence Foundation, where our national security begins.
As IT becomes more ingrained in agency missions, the acquisition process will need to become more responsive in meeting the needs of the technology workforce, especially since ongoing trends suggest 2012 will be a watershed year for reform. Join AFSEA Bethesda on May 24th at the Bethesda North Marriott as chief acquisition officers and senior procurement executives discuss how agencies and industry can work together to improve technology acquisition. Register today at AFSEABethesda.org/maybreakfast.
Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Stan Soloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. You can find them at pscouncil.org. Stan, there's something else going on regarding the changing definition of commercial items. Give me the deep dive here.
I don't want to put people back to sleep, but the key thing here is that back in the 90s, when the commercial items definition was established in law and in regulation, it was a recognition that when the government buys commercial items or services, there are often going to be some modifications need to be made to that item or service to meet the government's unique needs, but that it was still a commercial item or service. You know, the simplistic example people sometimes use, whether it's apocryphal or not, is the Army buying T-shirts, but the T-shirts don't come in Army green, so now you have to modify it to dye them the Army green. Still a commercial T-shirt. But that applies in a much broader set of sometimes even more sophisticated needs. The statute and the regulation have been in place for now about 15, 18 years, and there have been a couple of proposals over the last several years to change that definition, primarily focused on or driven by some concerns about how and where the commercial items designation has been used, principally in weapon systems. Because what it does is if you are able to sell under as a commercial item or service, you are not subject to the certified cost and pricing data requirements and cost accounting standards. The government's very unique cost accounting structure, which bears very little relationship to a commercial generally accepted accounting principles system that most companies, commercial companies, have. And there's been debate back and forth whether it's been used properly in this case or that case or and so forth. And some questions that have been raised, I think, are fair questions. I think that there may be some areas where it clearly was misused, and other areas I think there's a misunderstanding on some people's parts about what's actually taking place with the equipment being bought and so on. Nonetheless, it's been around. There have been, as I said, a couple of proposals to change the definition that have gone nowhere, and that the proposals are back again this year. And what the change would do, the key words in the definition that enable you to make these small modifications to accommodate the government are an item or service of a type sold or offered for sale to the general public, recognizing that there are some differences here. And the proposal is to get rid of the words of a type and offered for sale. So in other words, what you'd end up with is it would only be a commercial item or service if it was precisely the same item or service that you had actually sold in substantial quantities outside the government. So what is the ramification? I look at it from the professional services and technology base this way. I'll use an example. Amazon, Salesforce, Google, others who are in the market providing cloud services. Some of those cloud services do have minor modifications for the government, whether it's a unique security protocol or you designate what data warehouse you want to be using, whatever it might be. There are some modifications. None of these companies, for the purposes of that stuff they're selling, as far as I know, have set up unique government units with all the unique government cost accounting. It's part of their commercial organization. And I'm not sure we would want them to have to go that route. Under the new definition, I don't think they could continue to sell those services to the government. And frankly, I think some of them are concerned that they would not be able to continue to sell those services to the government. So what's really happened here, I mean, that's sort of the quick outline of what's going on. But what's really happened here is we've conflated two issues. There is concern. The concern about commercial items is what kind of pricing data, what kind of pricing information do we get? How do we ensure we're getting a fair and reasonable price? But when you ask, are people doing market research, really good market research? Are they doing what's known as dissimilar competitions? Are they using these tools that are out there to help them make sure they're getting a fair and reasonable price? Are they getting good competition? Are they writing good statements of work to get really good proposals and they really can compare? The answer comes back, probably not. And so I think this is really kind of a baby with the bathwater answer. When really the issue here is giving the workforce better and more sophisticated tools to do the analysis, and also training them better in what kinds of information they should be asking for, because it's not like they can't ask for pricing information. The law was changed a few years ago to reiterate that you can, in fact, ask for all kinds of pricing information to help establish a fair and reasonable level. So I think this is a workforce issue, and what's happened is it's conflated the question of what is commercial with how you price it. And they're different questions. How you price something doesn't determine whether or not it's commercial. It's either commercial or it's not. And therefore, I think the second question is best answered through much better workforce development and tools rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay. Is there any likely near-term resolution on this?
Well, it's a legislative proposal that the Defense Department has put forth that will be considered by the House and the Senate in the defense authorization bills. I'm cautiously optimistic that it will not fly as written. There may be some attempts to provide some more guidance around how pricing should work or what have you, but it's not going to, hopefully not going to change the definition and still enable the government to access a lot of technologies and capabilities that are very much commercial. And by the way, we should want this to happen. It expands the competitive aperture of the marketplace, which is, A, good for the government as the customer, more selection, more access to new stuff. It also puts competitive pressure on the existing marketplace to keep pace. So there's lots of good forces at work here. The more you can expand the competitive capabilities of the market and the more the expand the access of the government to solutions.
Well, it would seem to me that you'd also be in a better position to attract the best companies to provide these services.
To the extent that they're the ones that are developing and creating these new capabilities, absolutely.
Yeah. So AB and bathwater is an excellent analogy here. I want to open a can of worms right now, but yet another can of worms, I should say, because it is a hot topic lately, and it's one that's recurrent. It's, you know, it's happened before, it'll happen again, but low price technically acceptable seems to be a preferred way to write your contracts these days, and it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense in a lot of instances. But I'd like you to take a deep dive here.
There's no doubt that we are seeing a preponderance of acquisition strategies that are low price technically acceptable. In fact, it was as we surveyed our companies as part of a report we did for the Secretary of Defense on what we thought the impacts of the defense cuts might be. This was actually the number one issue that came back, which is, keep in mind, the number one issue that came back wasn't the budget, although there is obviously concern about the budget. It was how the government's buying and a recognition that when you have fiscal challenges such as we have, everybody recognizes them. We know that we have to deal with them. One of the natural market forces will be for folks who supply the government services or products to do whatever they have to do to book revenue to survive the downturn. It's a survival mode now. It's not a growth mode. And that how the government buys will determine on the back end whether the industry that emerges is a stronger, more high-performing, efficient industry, perhaps slightly winnowed down, or a very average, not very innovative industry. Because what are you rewarding and who's going to get the work over the next several years? Mm-hmm. As you said, I mean, low price technically acceptable is certainly appropriate in a lot of commodity areas and even certain services and so forth. But when you want technology refresher, you want innovation and so forth, you cannot buy on the cheap. And the government, we think two things have to happen. One is the government needs to focus on quality. This is not to suggest that they can afford to be gilding the cage in a down market when budgets are so tight. But there are ways in which you can give credit and should be giving credit for innovation and high performance and so forth in the technical awards. What level they set technical acceptability at is an absolutely critical question. In many cases, what we're hearing back from both government and industry is they're setting it really, really low, which means that's the best they're going to get, because if anybody meets that really, really low standard, then it's just a price shootout. So how they set the quality levels and so on becomes very important. And then, of course, for industry, it's critical that we do an excellent job of articulating in proposals in an objective, measurable way the value of whatever discriminators we are bringing to the table might be, performance enhancements or whatever it might be. What does that translate into in terms of additional capability and value and in a very objective, measurable way to help the customer better understand some of the solutions? I think this is a big question, a big challenge. We all know, as I said, that the budget is tight and agencies cannot afford to be buying more than they need. But what they need is not, we don't, I think, want a government that is made up of C and D level capabilities.
No.
And so we have to find a way to get to to level that out and manage that better.
Okay. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We will return after these messages.
Federal News Radio 1500 AM WFED. The American Veterans Center invites you to the 2012 National Memorial Day Parade, presented by Boeing, Monday, May 28th at 2 p.m. along Constitution Avenue. Join veterans groups, musical performers, hundreds of active duty troops, and celebrity veterans and supporters of the military, including Gary Sinise, Miss America 2012, and Grand Marshal and Air Force legend General Chuck Yeager. The parade is presented by Boeing, with additional support from the Association of American Railroads and many other generous sponsors. To learn more about how you can see the parade, visit NationalMemorialDayParade.com.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 260 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, what does your company do, John? My company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations that have programs for conformity assessment, accreditation, standards, and policy management. Is your agency responsible for conformity assessment? If so, then please visit our website, armaturecorp.com. We can help.
Vacation time is right around the corner. Why worry about the safety of your home while you're away?
I had Ackerman Security install a system 2 years ago. Now, I leave for vacations with total peace of mind. I know I can trust an Ackerman Certified Monitoring Center. They don't use a third-party monitoring company like most companies, and it's only $18.95 a month.
Call today and get 2 free months of Ackerman's award-winning basic monitoring. 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7222.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Looking for a professional master's degree that will take your career to the next level? The University of Maryland's Master's in Applied Economics can help you gain a valuable professional advantage and expand your career opportunities. Meet faculty and get your questions answered at the next information session, May 23rd at 6:30 p.m. in the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown D.C. Application deadline is June 1st. Details at masters.econ.umd.edu.
After a nationwide competition, a dozen student teams were recently selected to showcase innovative engineering projects by the National Collegiate Inventors and Innovators Alliance. A Baltimore team hopes to improve punch biopsies, the most common technique for getting skin samples that includes all layers. The procedure involves several tools, a circular blade, a punch tool, forceps, scissors, and Nishant Kumar, a junior at Johns Hopkins University, says,
depending on the expertise of the dermatologist, you could sometimes damage the integrity of the skin sample.
Kumar's team engineered a simple all-in-one punch device. Once inserted into the target skin sample, its innovation is a wire mechanism that acts like a cheese cutter.
It just cuts the skin at the bottom, so it separates the skin from the tissue underneath.
And pulls out a cleanly cut sample. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to our no-holds-barred forum for discussing what's good, bad, ugly, and just plain silly in the arena of doing business with the government. Stan Soloway is my guest today. Stan is the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. We've gone over the various hot topics here, the contractor salary issues, the commercial items, low price technically acceptable. Let's talk a little bit. In the Professional Services Council, obviously, is the you're like MOBUS for the contractor community, right? So, but like MOBUS, a lot of your membership is small and medium-sized companies.
Correct.
Let's talk about how they're dealing with these issues. What's it going to take for a small and medium-sized company to survive and thrive in this market?
You know, I think that one of the things that has occasionally been raised, we've seen it in policy and so forth, is, but not often enough, is that, A, the compression in the market, every impact that is felt by a larger company is felt many times more significantly by smaller companies, the smaller you are, whether it's access to talent and limitations on your ability to go out and get talent, and most specifically the cost of doing business with the federal government. Everybody who's in the market realizes this is not an easy market to get into. It's not an easy market to survive. But the costs of doing business with the government are clearly going up. A lot of the sort of liability and risk issues and so forth, the compliance requirements are increasing. And all of those pressures are greater the smaller the company. And I think that as we look at whether it's insourcing or any other pressure in the marketplace, smaller companies feel it more acutely. So they do have some unique challenges that unfortunately are not always accounted for when new policy proposals are issued. No one's really thinking sort of what the market looks like. There's, you know, a few large companies, but the bulk of the market in professional and technology services is medium and small companies. That's the way the market looks,
right?
Particularly smaller medium folks. So I think that those impacts are very real. The really sharp, effective, high-performing small companies, and we have a number of them in our membership, are hanging in there. I think the best ones are not looking at this as an opportunity, a time to go into adjacent markets, but really digging deep and delivering for their customers in the markets they're in. It's just a logic tree here, and that is, there's going to be fewer dollars. There's going to be more competition for the dollars. That's probably not a good time to go into new space because you're just coming into a place where the competition is that much fiercer. But, you know, smaller companies often have the good ones, the top ones, have really good customer relationships. They know how to engage with the customer. There's a lot of executive-level attention to customer service and to customer responsiveness. And I think that's a really, really key factor in surviving a downturn because you become somebody that the customer really knows they can rely on. That's not to say larger companies don't have that. I'm not suggesting this is unique to smaller companies. But for smaller companies with a smaller number of customers and a typically more a narrower base of customers, that's a really, I think, huge discriminator is the degree to which they can engage with and partner with, in the purest sense of the word, their customers. And so I see this, a lot of our small companies spending a lot of time really attentive to that. And I think for them, that is a key tool. I do worry, and a number of them worry, about the impact. We talked earlier today about low price technically acceptable and the sort of buying on the cheap. The smaller the company, the less possible that is to compete in, because you don't have the wherewithal to take no margins or to take a loss,
right,
in some cases, just to hold on to the revenue and weather the storm. And I think that there is some concern there. I mean, there are a number of them that do compete full and open. They don't only just compete with small businesses. And those competitive pressures are going to be tremendous. And I think another reason for the government to kind of think carefully about when and where to use low price versus at least some degree of cost technical trade-off, what some are beginning to call appropriate quality at the best price, which is not, again, gilding the cage, but actually a reasonable level of capability with reasonable credit for innovation and performance and so forth, is important for smaller companies. It's important for the government to recognize that that's going to be maybe more so than the small business targets. That's a way that small businesses can survive a downturn. So I think that's an important factor for the government to consider.
Okay. Now, for the small companies that have those relationships with the agencies, one of the criteria that Ed Smalley a few weeks ago was talking about was that customer relationship being absolutely critical for partner selection for him at Northrop Grumman Civilian. The other major criteria was owning a skill set that brought massive value to a particular program. How important is differentiation here? I mean, cyber's been with us since that first 15 feet of cable was strung, but very few people have acknowledged it seriously, and funding did not occur till recently. Now cyber has like 30 different subsets. Mm-hmm. How important is it for the small businesses to be truly among the best at what they do in those niches?
Well, I think it's very important, but I think that, again, there's two different pieces that he talked to, and I think they're both valid and relevant, either individually or together. One is deep customer relationships and deep knowledge of the customer. When we say relationship, what we're really talking about is knowledge of the customer's needs and a capability internally to the company and staffing and so forth that really is responsive to that requirement within engineering or whatever the specific field may be. There may be others who have that same capability, so it's not the differentiator that you're talking about, but they don't have that relationship and that institutional knowledge of the customer. That what that does for the customer is they know they're going to get great service and they're going to get responsiveness. So that's one. The other part is to have a unique capability that others do not have, particularly in the small business community and so forth. If you're looking to be a teaming partner or a subcontractor to a large prime, clearly that's always a path of, to the extent that unique capability is something needed, that's always a path to success. And those that can combine the two, of course, become, you know, even more successful. But you don't have to have an absolutely unique capability to be successful. It's you have to have really good qualifications and that customer knowledge sometimes is also adequate. So it's one, the other, or both.
Okay. Now, in the members that PSC has that qualify as small, do you have any that qualify, or how many do you have that qualify as one of the set-aside categories, service-disabled, vet, et cetera?
You know, I don't know what the exact statistics are. We have 360 member companies, and, 60% of our companies or 65% are small, mid-tier, or small businesses. I don't have an exact number that are actually service-disabled or other.
But they're represented in your membership.
We have them, yes.
Okay. In Ed's criteria, that was like third or fourth. So does that follow what you see in the market as well?
You know, it's hard to say, and I don't think that there's an automatic or linear assessment you can give to that, because it really depends on what the individual customer sets are looking for and how they're structuring their RFPs and what they're giving credit for. For small veteran-owned businesses, I think there's a big push for prime contracts. Not just subcontracting, but there's a lot of the agencies have goals now, and they're trying to build up their contracting with veteran-owned businesses. There have been some challenges in the program. I've heard a number of complaints about it, inconsistencies in certifications of companies or approval of companies actually being validated as veteran-owned and what have you. So it really depends on the customer set and what the customer is saying we're going to give credit for or we're going to require as a subcontract element and what have you.
Okay. Oh, Ed also did say that they are certainly not averse at Northrop to taking the subcontracting position with qualified leaders in the set-aside categories.
Sure, sure. So,
and that's not always been the case with any of the large primes.
Well, I think I can't speak for all of the large primes, obviously, although they're all members, but I can't speak for their individual programs. So they've all, over the years, evolved pretty mature programs and typically understand the market exceptionally well. They also realize, and I think we've seen a lot of cases of this, that compliance with the small business requirements in subcontracting, and also if you're a large company that's a sub to a small business prime, which is not unusual at all these days, making sure that you manage against the compliance requirements, the so-called 5149 rule, where you can.
Right.
That's a big challenge. That's not as easy as people think it is, because if you're on an IDIQ contract and the task orders keep coming out heavily weighted towards the work that 49% was on the team to do, all of a sudden you're bumping up against that ceiling, and managing against that is becoming very challenging. And I think companies are getting much more sophisticated about it because they have to, because the price of violating the rule is pretty high.
But when the task orders come out, if the small company's not capable of doing it, the only other option is to pass on the task order.
you either pass on it or you figure out a way to trade labor, or there's all kinds of strategies, but to make sure that you don't violate that threshold.
Sure, because then we get into the other can of worms, the waste, fraud, abuse syndrome.
Right, and there are going to be cases where people are doing it intentionally, and there are going to be cases where it's completely unintentional, and maybe they don't even realize that they've done it because of the complexity of the contract. But if it happens, it's automatically assumed to be fraud.
Yeah, and you know, automatically assumed is.
I think we often are beginning to equate mistakes with fraud automatically. They're like the default position too often.
Well, when they show up on the front page of the Post, you know, it's sort of hard not to make that assumption if you don't have some modicum of knowledge in the area. So we don't have to go there. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back in a minute.
At Kaiser Permanente, we're about keeping you connected. So we made My Health Manager. It connects you to your doctor, your prescriptions, your test results, and your health records right at home. But what if you aren't home? What if you're visiting family, or at the beach, or on a business trip? What if you're on a steep mountain trail, you know, with loose gravel and one way in and one way out? Now, there's the Kaiser Permanente mobile app. It connects you right from your smartphone. You can email your doctor while visiting family, refill your prescription from the beach, take your medical records on a business trip, or schedule, say, a little checkup from that steep trail. No matter where you are, we'll keep you connected without keeping you from any of life's adventures. Get the app by searching Kaiser Permanente in the Android market or bookmark kp.org on your smartphone. Coming soon to the Apple App Store, Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. Apple is the registered trademark of Apple Inc. Android is a trademark of Google Inc.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files in all these different formats, then 20 years later, somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Disabled American Veterans is dedicated to one single purpose, building better lives for America's disabled veterans. May 18th through the 20th, in the company of the vintage B-25 Mitchell Bomber, DAV brings its message of support for veterans to the Joint Base Andrews Air Show. In its modern-day mission with DAV, the B-25 serves as a reminder of the sacrifices veterans make for freedom. Meet the DAV flight team with the B-25 at the Joint Base Andrews Air Show.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, Thomas Seneca, partner with TM Wealth Management and head of alternative strategies. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com.
Hey man, what's that?
It's my new Pioneer DEH44 HD radio car receiver that I just got from Walmart for $120.
HD radio? What's that?
It's your extra local HD2 HD3 FM stations, but you need an HD radio receiver.
So I just need to buy an HD radio receiver?
Yeah, just visit HDradio.com for all the info. Then go to Walmart to buy your Pioneer DEH44 HD radio receiver for only $120.
Okay, HDradio.com, then to Walmart.
HD radio, more radio, more value.
Join FCEA Bethesda in congratulating the 2012 Government-Wide Initiatives Excellence Awards recipients. Winners include Mary Armstead, NIH Acquisition Award, Ron Graham, HHS Health IT Award, and Jack Bates, VA Big Data Award, as well as category winners from GSA, EPA, DOJ, and other government agencies. If you'd like to get involved with FCEA Bethesda, go to FCEABethesda.org for more information. That's FCEABethesda.org.
Registration is now open for the all-new Management of Change event,
featuring interactive sessions around cloud, mobility, and security, and a future technology expo, June 3rd through 5th at the Hyatt Regency, Cambridge, Maryland. This government industry training forum is hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council. Register and learn more at actgov.org/managementofchange. That's actgov.org/managementofchange.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Stan Solway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. You can find the Professional Services Council at pscouncil.org, and I suggest you do so. Stan writes a number of articles for trade publications. I am fond of posting many of these in various groups on LinkedIn, and occasionally I'll even tweet a couple. But always good reading, always good to have you here, by the way.
My pleasure.
So, last topic of the day, and it's a hot one, it's a recurrent one, and it's an onerous one, because we get into those arbitrary figures again, sequestration.
The potential for sequestration obviously is on everybody's mind, and for those who don't follow it carefully, that's just the term being used for the mandatory cuts to spending that were triggered by the failure of the supercommittee last summer to come up with a deficit reduction plan. You know, there's so many elements to this, but in my view, and I think most people's view, almost certain that we're not going to see an appropriations bill by the end of the fiscal year, so that we will be in one or more continuing resolutions going into FY13. That creates havoc for everybody, and every company is noticing, I think, that their customers are just completely uncertain as to what their funding levels are going to be, the timing, the pace, and so forth. Add to that tumult the potential chaos created by sequestration. Under sequestration, there will be a mandatory reduction in discretionary spending, give or take $100 billion a year over 10 years, half of which will come out of the defense budget and half of which will come out of the budgets on a pro rata basis across the rest of the agencies of government. Within that, very limited flexibility as to how the agencies use the money they do get, because the law requires the cuts to go down through the agencies on a pro rata basis within the agency to your lowest line of appropriations. And so wherever your lines of appropriations end above that, you're taking automatic cuts. You can't decide that this program is more important than that program, so I'll defund this one to fund this if that other program's a line of appropriation. It's only underneath that you get the ability to have flexibility. And the OMB and the president will make some determinations, and there's some legal interpretations of how this works. It's not entirely clean. It's something we haven't actually done before. But it is a real threat, and I think people are beginning to realize that this is not a wink and a nod. This is not something that says, well, they'll never let it happen. Right now, there's very little evidence that there's a way to get around sequestration, that there's no mechanism, politically or otherwise, to solve the problem, certainly before the elections. And I think that there is a good chance that after the elections, one of two things are going to happen. There is some possibility, depending on what happens in the elections and the public mood, and if we have an outbreak of statesmanship, that in a lame duck Congress, there is a possibility they may opt to pass a legislation to delay sequestration, maybe to like April. That's one possibility, assuming that the president would support it. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that sequestration actually does go into effect. It doesn't go into effect till January 2nd, which is another complication. So you have one quarter of the fiscal year under current rules, and then all of a sudden things change going into the second quarter. And then if it does go into effect in January, is it immediate, or are agencies told to try to push the cuts out till later in the year so that there's some time for the new Congress and the president to work out some sort of compromise and to deal with it? Because I don't think anybody really wants it to happen, as one colleague said, and I shamelessly steal his line, the reality of pain is much more powerful than the threat of pain. When they're up close and personal with the impacts, will there be a movement to get real and to try to figure out the best way to go forward? All of that said, also keep in mind that, number one, the so-called Ryan budget on the House side actually set spending levels below the agreed levels in the Budget Control Act. So there are at least one portion of one party in one house is saying, we think the Budget Control Act levels are already too high. Second, for some of the civilian agencies, ironically, sequestration would actually be good news because the percentage cuts they'd be required to take might be less, might be, I use the term advisedly, than those being proposed either by the president and or by the Republican budget. So depending on where you sit, depends on what the impacts are going to be. And I think if you look at, for instance, the Defense Department, we're talking about a very, very significant impact here. I think I saw a figure yesterday that said the estimates now government-wide is the average will be 12% per agency. And that's a very big number. And DOD is looking at a 9 to 13%. There's some question, as you've probably seen in the media, whether the Veterans Affairs Department is exempt because of other statutory protection. You'll have elements that are protected. I would assume pay is protected, military and civilian and what have you. But I don't think we know all the answers to those questions. Bottom line is, from an industry perspective, A, companies need to be planning for this possibility. Although agencies are not doing specific planning on how to handle sequestration, they don't have their apportionment instructions yet or anything, companies need to be planning for it. And I think second, recognize that for the customer base, this is just wrecking havoc, and it's creating chaos and making planning almost impossible on their part. So we shouldn't be surprised that one of the impacts are program delays and an unwillingness or a reticence to make long-term commitments.
Well, how do you write your 53s and 300s?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, you write them, the instructions, you write them status quo. Okay. But what if status quo changes?
No, well, status quo is going to change one way or the other because, you know, the economy is just in the toilet. But the whole thought of, you know, the arbitrary 13%, I mean, super committee aside, I mean, you know, they didn't do a job. The construction of the elements of the committee, I think you could have predicted that when they got together. But let's go back to those small and medium-sized companies that you represent. You had indicated that the market compression squeezes small businesses a lot more. How much more can they be squeezed and still be viable contenders?
Well, I mean, I think that the pressures do impact them more. Now, when you're talking about something like sequestration and so forth, none of this would obviate the requirements associated, for instance, with the small business goals and so on. Agencies would still say, whatever they're spending, X percentage. So there's clearly an impact there, but there will still be the pressure to do that. I think everybody on this one is uncertain as to what its impacts are going to be. We know it's going to be tough. It's already kind of a tough market. I think the industry, the professional services and technology industry that serves government, will come out of this in several years as we deal with, obviously, fiscal issues we clearly have to deal with as a continued strong industry. I mean, this is not going away. The sky isn't falling. But trying to figure out and to figure out exactly where it's going and the pace and needs of customers and so forth is harder today than it's ever been. And as always, as I said, the compression tends to be tougher, particularly for small mid-tier firms and small businesses.
There you go. Stan, always a pleasure to have you on the show, man.
Thank you, Mark. Always great to be here.
Appreciate it. Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. Find them at pscouncil.org. This is not my day job. The Government Market Master Program for Continuing Professional Education rolls out this June. With my partner, Capital College in Laurel, Maryland. Check it out at capital-college.edu/GMM for education and sales, marketing, business development, social media, and for those C-levels novice to the government market, we will also show you how to run your business. Thanks for listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.